rather nostalgic, isn't it? Today we're talking away with Mr. Midlands, Bob Warman. Hello there, Greg Haynes with you. Welcome to the latest Talking Away. And that jingle you heard at the top there was the music, the well-recognised music for those of you in the Midlands, I'm sure, of ATV. And that's where the career of Bob Warman really took off back in 1973. But in 2022, last year, came this.
Now, before we go tonight, you've gone viral with this, Bob. What's your news? Come on.
I'm dreading this moment.
I know you are. We all are.
Well, it's to say that I am actually leaving you after nearly 50 years. I'm vacating the seat here.
I'm gutted. But you have 1973, you started.
Yeah.
I was four.
Yes.
But you've covered every story going.
Well, it seems like every type of story. It really does. The good, the bad, and the ugly, as they say. But social media being what it is, of course, the word is out. The messages have come in like rain. I'm almost feeling guilty that I'm going. I really am. But you can't make a decision like this without some misgivings. And because the viewers, the colleagues, you're all like extended family. It's been a huge privilege over the years.
Well, it really was an emotional goodbye from Bob. That was April 2022, and the actual goodbye came on Independence Day, July the 4th, 2022. This was the final goodbye.
Well, I have to say, you know, I've been absolutely inundated with goodwill messages and cards from viewers who have been watching our programme for years and years, and viewers who've grown up with me from a young age, and they're now in their 50s and 60s. Yeah. Extraordinary feeling. How do you repay that sort of loyalty, other than to say thank you and to let you know what a real pleasure and privilege it's been to be in your living room throughout the years? You'll always be the finest audience in the finest region. I believe that. And although I'm leaving Central, well, I certainly won't be leaving the region. So exciting times ahead. But from now on, I'll be one of the viewers and watching the news rather than relating it. But for now, a very big thank you and my warmest wishes to each and every one of you.
And Bob joins us now. Bob, thanks ever so much for joining us on Talking Away. What's it been like then being one of the viewers so far? Has it been a bit strange?
Well, listening to that, I feel quite emotional now. Has it been strange? Yes, it has. People are constantly saying in the street, they say, "Oh, hello, Bob. You know, how's retirement?" And my stock answer is, well, I recommend it to everybody because actually I'm really enjoying being retired. I haven't totally packed it in. You know, there are one or two things I'm still doing, but certainly I've packed in the daily job. And I haven't actually missed the job at all, thank heavens. But I've missed the people that I've worked with. I do miss them a lot. Because as I said, you know, in my sort of final goodbye, they're a wonderful family of people who I've come to know and to trust over many years. So, yes, of course, I miss them, yes.
That was Samina Ali Khan, of course, your last regular co-host, wasn't it? We'll obviously talk about how it started, Bob, and how you came into TV and print journalism and the many other things you've done over the years. But let's start at the end. How did you decide this was the time to go? Did something key happen that you thought, I think I'm ready to call it a day now?
It was a fairly, I'd probably subconsciously been thinking of packing it in for some time, but sort of putting the day off. And then one day I was driving down, you know, the same old route into work one day, and I thought, no, this is it. I had a sort of sudden epiphany, if you like.
Really?
And I thought, no, this is ridiculous. Time is running. at the time I was, 75, going on 76, and I was thinking, they're not that many years ahead, certainly not as many years as have gone behind me. And I thought, no, I want to do other things now. And I had nothing really specific in mind, actually, Greg, but it was a feeling that I enjoy life and I know the things that I do enjoy. And I wanted to do more of the things that I enjoy. And you can't do that when you're watching the clock every lunchtime or 6 o'clock. You're tied into the studio, and that is the trouble. That's the only problem with live television. It's a bit like being the violin player. You've got to be there to make the music, and having been restricted in that way for so many years, I thought, no, I just want to free up time.
I suppose as well, when you're doing news like that, even when you're not live or not broadcasting, I suppose you're in your head, you're constantly live, aren't you? Keeping on top of everything.
Well, you are. Yes, the news never lets you go. And by the way, I'm still a bit of a news junkie now, but I'm always, if I'm hanging around the house, I've either got the radio on or I've got the television on, and I can't stop watching the news. I enjoy news. I enjoy being abreast of what's going on, and occasionally sort of throwing a slipper at the television if I disagree with something.
Well, I mean, let's go back right to the beginning then. How did it start? You were born, Bob, in Warsaw, the Chicory district, on the 11th of October 1946, which is just one day in the same year after Chris Tarrant, by the way, which I thought was a funny coincidence. Then you went to Kings and Grange Prep School in Shrewsbury, now Shrewsbury High, with a good mate, of course, your rival / friend on BBC Midlands Today, Nick Owen. We've got some words from Nick, because we've seen so many tributes, especially since the retirement was announced. So let's just listen into a couple of people you know well. Nick Owen, and first of all, voice of the news at 10, Mary Nightingale.
He is such a warm, brilliant professional, and I can't quite imagine TV without him, to be honest.
We both got to know each other. We were both in short trousers. Bob was taller than me then, and he still is. I was lucky enough to have a transistor radio when there weren't many around then, and Bob was desperate to borrow it to listen to Radio Luxembourg in his dormitory at night. So I said, well, I want to listen to it. And he said, I'll give you a record. So he gave me a pop record by Cliff Richard, Travelling Light. Everyone I've spoken to about Bob retiring, and everyone's coming up to me and saying to me about him giving up the job, will say it won't be the same without him.
I don't think he's given you the Cliff Richard record back, has he?
Apparently not, no. I know he's got it, yeah. Yeah, it was Travelling Light on the one side, and Dynamite was the flip side as well. he's still got it, yeah. Oh, dear old Nick. Yeah, well, of course. I mean, when I think about it now, he is, I suppose, my oldest friend. I mean, we met when we were, he was about 7.5, 8 years old. And we were away at this prep school in Shrewsbury. It was a very strange thing, actually, that I was sent away to school. I always think it's a bit odd. And sadly, my parents aren't around now, so I asked them really why on earth they did it. But anyway, they did. I think we're all part of some sort of post-war experiment, really, of a new way of doing things and so on. And I know that Nick and I share another coincidence in that our fathers were in the teaching profession. My father was a teacher in Warsaw. And Nick's father, if I've got this right, I'm sure I have, I think he was headmaster of Berkhamsted Grammar School. So we're in the teaching profession. And what I did learn later on in life was that there was quite a massive discount for the children of teachers if you were sent to this school. So they probably thought, we'll take advantage of that.
Yeah.
But I found it quite tough, actually. Looking back, and of course, it wasn't so many years after the war. We're going back to, 1950, I can't think what it was now, about 1955, 56. And it wasn't so many years after the war. And, the luxuries weren't around as they are today. Nick did have a little transistor radio, and I was extremely envious of that, because he could get into Radio Luxembourg late at night with a little earplug plugged in his ear. And Radio Luxembourg in those days was about the only station that played any pop music, so I was very envious of that. But we came through that school together, and it's extraordinary that we sort of leapfrogged each other over the years through radio, through newspapers, first of all, then radio, then television, and ending up doing the 6 o'clock and 6:30 show. People say it's against each other, but it's not really. I think there's more rivalry years ago when we both used to go out at 6 o'clock. Then there's some real rivalry. But our programs are, you know, they have their own followers, don't they? They have their own loyalties. And the people who always say, we only watch the BBC, that sort of thing. No, you don't. Of course you watch other TV. Well, of course.
It's uncanny, though.
Yeah. Oh, she's uncanny, yes.
Isn't it like you're in the same dormitory even, Bob, and then you end up doing BBC and ITV at the same time. You couldn't make it up, could you, really?
Well, you couldn't. You absolutely couldn't. And I remember one day, I forget now when it was, but it was when Nick was working at ITV for a time in sports. And I remember an MP came in, a chap called Latham. He was an MP somewhere in Northamptonshire, I think. And he came into the studios, and Nick said, "Do you realise we're all in the same dormitory half a century ago?"
Wow.
And the funny thing, you know, because if the three of us had been together in that dormitory and sort of said, "Well, what are we going to be doing in about sort of 40 years?" I know, I'm going to be an MP, and you two are going to be on television, one of you on BBC and one of you on ITV. It is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? My brother, elder brother by 8.5 years, there's quite a gap between us, but he was in journalism and, you know, working in an environment which he thoroughly enjoyed. And after a couple of years of working in civil engineering, I realized that I wasn't enjoying it so much. I wasn't getting the same sort of thrill that my brother was getting. Mm. And I knew a lot of journalists in those days. We all used to drink in the same coffee bar in Warsaw, actually, and which is my hometown. And I used to love the cut and thrust of these young journalists and so on. They seem to be having a much more interesting life than me. And I, almost by I fell into journalism because I suddenly got interested in their world. And it was, how shall I put it? I knew that I wasn't going to be in civil engineering for the rest of my life. And I remember my mother saying to me, not my father so much, but my mother saying to me, "Listen, if you're not going to enjoy it, for God's sake, get out of it and get into something that you know you're going to enjoy, because you're going to be in work for a very long time and you must do something that you enjoy." And I said, I'm going to have a crack at journalism. She said, "Well, you do that then. But, you know, make sure you make a good job of it, you know." And from the moment I joined a local newspaper, I fell into a world which I absolutely loved and have loved ever since. I was very lucky that way. Not everybody has that sort of luck, you know. I mean, it's a great privilege, isn't it, to be in a job that you really love. Mm. Oh, it really is, yeah, yeah.
Of course, it's changed so much, hasn't it, in the last 10 or 15 years with social media. What's your opinions on it, Bob? Because I have to say, when it started, I really loved Twitter, but now I can't stand it, to be honest. Although I use it to promote the podcast, to use it as a personal account to show people what I'm having for breakfast, or I don't know, I just find it very negative, very time consuming. I'm interested to know what you think.
Ooh, boy, you're opening up a subject there. What do I think of social media? Well, as a means of spreading the word around quickly, it's unbeatable.
That's
it's fantastic.
True.
But I avoid it like the plague. I really do avoid it because it's full of man traps, bear traps, if you like. And you've only got to see the Twitter storm concerning the BBC and our friend there. Now, people have asked for my opinion about it, and I'm careful what I say. But what I would say is that to be able to broadcast to people is a massive privilege. And it's, in my books, it's a privilege which you don't abuse. And I've never abused it over the 50 years that I've been on television. I've always been pretty careful what I say. And certainly, I'm not interested in other people's views. Everybody's entitled to their own view. Of course they are. But I think, you know, when it comes to politics particularly, we're so polarized in this country, best to keep away from it. I mean, people might have a suspicion about which way I vote, but nobody really knows. Now, I know a lot of – I can look at various people on television nowadays, and I know exactly how they vote.
Yeah.
Because they let you know, don't they? They tell you.
Yeah,
you know,
they do.
And it polarizes. You know, it's a bit – I'll tell you what it's like, Greg. It's like people say to me, Bob, which who do you support? Which team do you support? Now, again, that's a difficult one, you see, for a broadcaster, because if you say, well, I support, you know, the Blues, then all the Aston Villa people think, well, I don't like that guy anymore.
That's true. You know?
Well, they do. I mean, and, you know, the loyalties are so fierce in this part of the world. I mean, where I live, they're by and large Albion supporters. You know, I'm southwest of Brum, so they're mainly sort of Albion supporters, a few Wolves supporters and so on, very few Villa supporters here. But of course, if you go north, you know, up into the St. Colford area, et cetera, et cetera, or anywhere north Birmingham, it's Villa. It's Villa land, isn't it? So, and people have these very fierce loyalties. So when people say to me, who do you support, Bob? I say, Walsall.
Okay, yeah, is that the safe option? So,
it's a very safe option that people look at you a bit sadly and say, oh, all right, and then they sort of move on, you know. But you've got to be careful in our game, you know, about declaring who you support, what you support, you know, giving opinions on things. I prefer to keep away from it. I really do.
Talking of geographical locations, Bob, here's a clip from you played out on the TV some years ago. Let's just have a listen and then we'll react to this.
People are always asking me, forever asking me, why didn't you move to London? I don't want to move to London. I never wanted to move to London. I live in a wonderful part of the world. I was born in what used to be Staffordshire. I was educated in Shropshire. I work in what used to be Warwickshire. And I live in Worcestershire. And taken together, that's a magnificent, magnificent part of the world.
Now, having grown up in Ulster and Warwickshire and having been born and lived in Bromsgrove the first few years of my life, Bob, I've got to say I completely agree with you. But it does seem as though there's a pressure, doesn't there, sometimes in media to get to London? And as you've proven, you don't have to be living in London.
You don't. Now, what would my advice be to somebody? I don't know. I've been very lucky. I've chosen to be in this part of the world. And over the years, I've had various businesses and so on, which I've set up in this part of the world. And I enjoy it. I mean, there's only one thing missing, isn't it? And it's coastline.
Yes.
And but the funny thing is, you know, every time I go to the coast and I look out at sea, I sort of think, oh, that's very nice. And then I turn around and look at what's over my shoulder behind. Mm. And in truth, I love the countryside. I don't really miss the seaside that much. I mean, it's nice to have a bit of, you know, to be to have a bit of coast and so on. But this part of the world is it's magnificent, and it's partly magnificent because it's not London. I know London's fine, you know, and I used to work in London many years ago for a short time on Fleet Street, and I enjoyed my time down there, and I've my son lives in London now, and I enjoy going down to see him and so on. Do I want to live there? Oh, God, no. And did I ever really want to work there? No, I didn't. I made that decision many years ago, that I didn't really want to work in London. Having said all that, Greg, I look at people who've gone to London, and they've really thrived. I mean, people who started at Central. People like Rohit Kashru, you know, I mean, now, you know, Dan Hewitt. I mean, these are really good frontline reporters. They're absolutely superb at their job. They cut their teeth in the Midlands, but they've really made a name for themselves by going to London. I think also curiosity. You've got to be curious. You've got to always want to be asking questions. You know, you want to know what's going on. You want to know how people do it, the who, what, where, how, all those questions which a journalist has. And you've got to retain those throughout your working life if you want to be successful.
Do you almost have to see yourself as sitting on the sofa and be thinking, now, what would I want to be knowing if I was at home? What, you know, is it your duty in a way to ask the questions you think you should be asking as opposed to what you might actually want to ask?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that's all about knowing your audience as well, is knowing, you want to sort of ask the questions that any intelligent member of the audience would want to ask, given the opportunity. And I think if you can crack that, you've sorted it. Sometimes I've had situations with interviews where I've done an interview and I've thought afterwards, I've looked at it afterwards and I've thought, actually, I should have asked that question because there's still a question hanging. And very often when I'm watching other people or interviews on television nowadays, I sort of think, ask that, for God's sake, ask that. And the interview will finish. I'm thinking, well, they never asked the question.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Yeah.
So, being able to kind of read the audience mind is quite important. Well, it's very important.
I always find it amazing as well when you get reporters who they've clearly listed the questions and they're going, you can see them going through it in their head, but they're not actually listening to what the interviewee has answered. So they might drop a clanger and, you've got them and there might be a really interesting thing to pick them up on. But because they're not actually listening to what they're saying, they just overlook it, don't they? And they often ask a question that's already been answered, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, I put that down to lack of experience and very, very often nervousness. I remember in my very early days in broadcasting, and I used to make the mistake of writing out a list of questions and going through the list of questions. And I learned that you need to listen to answers. You need to listen carefully to answers. And I always remember going to interview Enoch Powell at his home in Wolverhampton. And I went with a sort of list of questions in my head. I hadn't been in broadcasting very long, actually, and I was rather nervous of coming up against this man who got a huge intellect. I mean, he got an intellect as big as a house. And I went to my list of questions and I asked the first question. And he knew exactly which way I was going. And he answered all my subsequent questions in the first answer. and I was down to virtually asking him what's the color of his socks. I mean, it's a thing which happens with tends to be sort of inexperienced interviewers who are nervous. It's a nerve wracking game. If you're going up against a big cheese, you sort of think, oh, I'll get all my questions, all mapped out there. But it's not a bad idea, actually. I mean, to have a few headers and not the actual questions, but a few headers of where you want to go with the interview, because you never quite know in a live situation which way the interview is going to go. But you know the points you want to cover. And if you can, so it's not a bad idea just to have a little aid memoir, just to give you those headings. But I think listening to the answers is very important, because there'll be, a follow-up question to an answer, as there is with any conversation. It's one of the reasons, I mean, one of the things I've always enjoyed having a fellow presenter, especially somebody, Samina was she's a wonderful fellow presenter to have. She's very supportive and she's and you fire off each other very well and so on. But we both agreed that when it comes to interviews, we much prefer to do an interview of what we call a one-on-one rather than a two-on-one. Mm, mm. If you understand my the technical term there, you can't read your fellow presenter's mind if you're doing an interview. And I hate these interviews and you see it a lot. You see it a lot on breakfast television as well, don't you? Or morning television, where one person asks a question, then the other one has to ask a question because it's his turn. Then it goes, well, her turn.
Yeah.
Then it comes back to the, and you sort of think, oh, this interview is not going the right way at all. And it's much better to have a one-on-one interview, because that's how people talk to each other. That's how people normally talk to each other. You don't normally get two people talking to one person, and it's not so natural, really. funny enough, you know, television, the idea of the double presentation, I can't think when it came in now, so many years ago, but I suspect it was probably an Americanism, really. But when it came in, I was always a bit uncomfortable with it. I mean, I grew to like it in the end because I, particularly if you get those sort of families that we've developed. I mean, it'd be me, Samina, and Des on the weather forecast and so on. It was a great sort of family feel. It was a good team feel. I liked that very much. When it first came in, I was quite uncomfortable with it, really. It didn't feel natural. And of course, when you think about it, it's not really natural, is it? Two people talking to you.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because my hero was the great Murray Walker, who I sadly never met. I'm guessing you met Murray, didn't you, at some point, Bob, over the years?
Yes, I did. Not very often, but I did meet Murray. And what a fabulous chap.
It's funny because when he was paired up with James Hunt, he didn't like it at all. He thought, James Hunt, what's he coming in for? He doesn't know anything about commentating. He's a racing driver. And they actually made them share the Coles lip mic in the commentary box to make sure they didn't talk over each other.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's believable, though, isn't it? Yeah, even Murray said two very well-developed egos both felt what they wanted to say was more important than the other one. So the only way to stop them was, make them share the microphone. And then I think they had the problem of handing it over when they'd finished and trying to hold the mic. But it's believable.
Yeah, it is believable, yeah.
Well, Bob, since the retirement announcement last April, there's a lot of reaction. And I guess the most important reaction of all, as much as we love our colleagues, is from the public. And there was certainly a very, very nice reaction from the public in Birmingham and all around the Midlands.
Hi, Bob. Happy retirement.
It won't be the same central news. Bob was more than just the news. He just made the news more interesting.
I'd just like to tell him I shall miss him when he goes, watching him on telly. And good luck for the future for him. Think about it very often.
We've lived a few different places in the Midlands, and it's just always been there. A friendly face.
I remember him being on Yorkshire television in probably the late 60s, early 70s. And then he must have moved to Midlands after that. But yeah, very good presenter.
I met him at the St Paul's Church a couple of years ago. Got his autograph. Yeah. I say he's a nice chap.
And he's always very smartly dressed. It's just him. I think he's a very, very nice, thoroughly nice man.
I didn't realise he was that old. What the hell? He don't look it, does he?
There's only going to be one Bob Orman. The others are going to come with their own style and their own thing going on. Because there's only going to be one Bob.
Well, I've always enjoyed your presentation, very professional, and I wish you a happy retirement.
Bob, I've grew up with you for X amount of years. You made Central News what it was, and unfortunately, it will not be the same without you. But all the best in your retirement, and I wish you a long and fulfilled life, as you have made mine. All the best, and thank you very, very, very much.
Have a good time, Bob.
Happy retirement, Bob. Well done to you, mate.
Some really, really nice words there. And it seems like the overriding feeling is what a nice guy Bob is, even though they've never actually met you in person, probably.
Well, I mean, what lovely people. I really mean that. Yeah. Some lovely people. You know, sometimes, I'll be with my partner or something, and we'll be, we'll just be going shopping, and somebody will come up and talk to me, and she'll ask me, she'll say, well, did you know that person? I say, well, no, but yes.
Yeah, yeah.
because they know me as if I've been a lifelong friend, which in a sense I have been, because I've been on their screens for the best part of half a century. So people do know me. I mean, people see me more than they see their relatives.
Yeah,
very often.
That's true.
And so over the years, they've really come to know me. So when I meet them face to face in the street, they greet me like an old friend, and I can't help but react to them as if they are old friends, and I love it. People say, oh, do you ever get fed up of people coming up to you and talking to you? I say, well, no, I don't. Of course I don't. You know, it's a massive privilege to have people being, let's be honest, being nice to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a massive privilege. Good Lord. You know, who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want it? You know, it's I love it. Yeah, I mean, put it this way: you, I don't know how to put it really, but you just feel loved, and that's a lovely feeling, you know. It's a really nice feeling, and to be able to develop that through being on television is, as I say, I keep saying this word privilege, but it is and has been a massive privilege.
So we'll go through some of the professional things, and we want to talk about bikes as well, don't we? Because Bob and I were chatting before we went on air, as it were. And there's a connection with Ulster in Warwickshire and Percy Tate, who I didn't know was a good friend of yours. So we'll come to that as well. But before Central, Bob, of course, there was ATV, wasn't there? Which started in Birmingham in the black and white days, 1956. But you joined in 1973 and you'd gone through the Warsaw Observer, the Birmingham Post, the Birmingham Mail. So how was the move into TV? How did it happen? What was it like? And is it true that Sue Jay, one of the main reporters there, referred to you as the Adonis, and you were actually known within the company as Roger Moore?
Well, I didn't know that. I wish I'd known it at the time. And you can imagine, I would have taken full advantage of it. But I didn't know that. Reasonably smart, clean-cut looking lad, you know, so I won't go any further than that. But anyway, how did it happen? Well, I was working on the Evening Mail for a few years, and I worked in the Fleet Street office for a time. And when I came back, I remember the news editor saying to me, he did a good job down there, but by the way, what are you being paid? And I told him what I was being paid, and he said, God, blimey, he said, you should be paid more than that. He said, hey, how long are you? I said, I've been paid the same since I joined the Mail. He said, oh, I'll go and have a word with the editor. So he went to have a word with the editor and came back and said, the editor will see you now. I thought, oh, I think I'm in for a pay rise. Now, interestingly, the editor, who was a bit of an ivory tower sort of editor, you didn't see him very much unless there was trouble. He said to me, I understand things have gone quite well down at Fleet Street and so on, and good to have you back and so on. He said, I'm told there's a question about money. And I raised an eyebrow and he said, well, I don't think we're going to be paying you anymore. He said, you seem to be paid sufficiently, really. And he said, I don't really see you staying here for very long. And I thought, and as I came out of the office, the news editor said to me, how did you get on, Bob? I said, well, I said, there's no more money on the table. And I'm not so sure. It was actually suggesting that I'd got a job for very long, really. And he said, oh, he's just having one of those days. Well, it may have been one of those days for the editor, but for me, it was a bit of a crusher. It's not that I was desperately looking for money or anything like that, and I was happy doing my job. Like I say, I was a very happy journalist. I liked the job. But it did make me think. It was a bit of a crusher. And anyway, I got to only about a weekend after that, I bumped into the station manager of a new thing called Radio Birmingham, which, of course, became BBC Radio WM. And I got talking to him, and I said, and he said, what do you do? And so I told him, he said, have you ever thought about coming into broadcasting? I said, well, I haven't really. He said, well, why don't you come and see me? So I went to see him down at the old Pebble Mill Studios, and we seemed to get on very well. He said, well, why don't we go and have a spot of lunch, which meant why don't you come to the bar? Because in those days they had a bar. Can you believe it? In those days they had bars in the studios. So we went to the bar, and after what I call a hydraulic lunch rather than solids, he said, you got the job. He said, you can start when you want. And he told me what the salary was, which was more than double what I was getting at the Evening Mail.
Wow.
I thought, right. I thought, this is where I make the jump. And that's how I got into broadcasting journalism. And I loved it. I loved working in radio. That it was an entirely fresh way of doing things, a rather different way. You know, I wasn't having to sort of jotting down notes. I was using a microphone instead. And I found it a very exciting, a very new way for me of doing my job. And then I heard that a chap was leaving ITV. In those days, ATV Today. This is the old way, you see. I was in Broad Street at the Transport and General Workers Union head offices at transport house in Broad Street. And I did a very dull interview with some union leader and so on. I came out mid-morning and I was walking down the street and I heard this row coming out of a pub. And I put my head around the corner. It was a load of chaps from ATV or ATV Today. And there was a fellow, I mean, you may remember the name John Swallow, but yes. He was a reporter, yeah. Very amusing reporter. I mean, a great chap, great reporter. And he said, "I'm leaving." And I said, "You mean you're leaving?" He said, "Yeah, I'm leaving. He said, I'm going to work in my father-in-law's business and so on." I said, "Oh, good Lord." I said, "So you mean there's actually a vacancy now?" He said, "There certainly is." So anyway, I went across the road and knocked on the door. And I said, "I understand that you're one of your reporters, John Swallow, is leaving. I'd like to be considered for a job." And that's how I got the job. It's as simple as that. I mean, it makes it sound so easy, doesn't it? But you know, the funny thing about journalism, you can do all the college work you like and come out with various degrees. And at the end of the day, you've just got to take your chances when you see them or when you hear about them. And I'm a great believer in grabbing the brass ring as it's being handed around. Mm-hmm. If it's warm, go for it, you know. And that's how I got into broadcasting, into television broadcasting.
It's funny you mentioned John Swallow, actually, because certainly in the later years, he became very known for the light-hearted items, didn't he, which we always had on Central News. Do you remember the one with the vicar?
Well, I do, yes. very much so. Well, the irony was that John was back in his old job within 6 months. I mean, he went to work for his father-in-law's business and made a complete hash of it, I think. And there he was. He was back in his old job as part of the team again, but that's how I got into journalism. Yeah.
Well, there's loads of highlights of yours to go through, Bob. But now you've mentioned John Swallow, I was going to bring this in afterwards, but I think we better have a listen now. Here's the vicar.
Ready?
I'm fine. Yes.
Hold tight.
Well, it's absolutely petrifying standing here against the target board. The mouth's all dry. I could do with a pint. I really could, but the lads are all ready to throw, and here we go. I'm supposed to be smiling when this happens. Oh! Ow! Oh! Oh, God, that's it. Oh, no, it didn't. Ow! Hold it.
That was the knife throwing as well at the end there. I think that's what was always great. Oh, yeah. Local news, you had these light-hearted moments as well as some really negative stuff.
Well, there was much more of it in those days as well.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the program was very light-hearted. And it probably would not be considered serious journalism in any shape or form. But by God, it was fun. And the audience loved it, of course. They loved these things. And I remember that. I don't know if it was the same vicar who could do steam engines as well. He was fantastic.
Yes, I believe it was. Yeah.
We used to find these people. And John Swallow used to really exploit these eccentrics who exist around the ministry. And of course, they're still there today. I mean, the world's full of eccentrics. But John used to dig them out and make the best of them. And he had a wonderful manner about them because he'd take the mickey out of them without being offensive. And that's a great skill as well. He was terrific. Very sadly, no longer with us. But he was a wonderful reporter. And particularly when he teamed up with these eccentrics, he really was.
Well, there's one more I've got to play in of John, Bob, which is my personal favourite. For anybody who's not seen this before, this was one of the canals, you probably know better than me, Bob, around the Birmingham area. Yeah. And this is Basil the Duck, who I believe had been causing some problems for local residents. And I think John thought he'd got away with it, but of course he hadn't.
I've been hearing things about you, Basil. Good morning. Good morning. There, good boy. Wag your tail, that's it.
No, I don't think you are going to bite me, are you?
Uncle John's just getting a little worried, but... Ow! Right! Oh, my God! God, blimey. Well, I needed no hospital treatment, but I suggest to British Waterways, put up a sign. Beware of Basil the Duck. He's a potential killer, that one.
He didn't let the sign down, did he?
I think we need more of that, Bob. We need more of that, don't we? Basil the Duck.
Oh, God, I loved it, yeah. Oh, he's terrific. He was terrific. You see, the thing is, you come off a programme like that, and people will be talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about it still now. What is it, 30 years later?
Years later. Got to be, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, it's terrific stuff. Yeah.
Well, obviously, sadly, there's been some bad news over the years as well. And, Bob, you've been involved in many of them.
lunchtime news for the central region, and we begin with football.
My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I am certain.
Hello, and today in the special edition of Central News, we report on the tragic events in Handsworth.
When I was a kid, which was not that long ago, the black country always began in the next town. Because you didn't want to belong to the black country.
Now everyone wants to belong to the black country,
so it's expanding all the time now.
It looks peaceful enough now, but on Friday the quiet scene of this Cathedral City girls' school was shattered by the shrieks and howls of delight as dozens of young ladies hurled flour and eggs at each other.
Good evening for the thousands of people who work here and the many thousands more who are reliant on the money they earn. This week's events have been sudden and they've been devastating. Today, MG Rover confirmed it had called in the administrators. This afternoon, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor arrived in Birmingham to face the nightmare of Longbridge going bust in the run-up to a general election.
Yeah, there's been some pretty appalling news over the years, Bob, as well as the good news. The Handsworth riots, of course, the Kegworth air disaster. We heard the Rover crisis there, and you were there on the scene at Longbridge in the year 2000. Where did it all go wrong? Because the manufacturing industry in Birmingham was the place to be, wasn't it? And now it feels as though we've hardly got anything left.
God, yes, I know. Well, you played some very interesting clips there. Gosh, yes. The Austin Rover one was devastating, actually, to think that part of the staple of being in the West Midlands, but think of all the others as well. Think of all the motorcycle industry that went. I mean, a lot of it's come back now. I mean, Triumph is a massive success. It's a great success again. Do you remember the days of Triumph at Meriden where it went down the tubes there? Of course, BSA went. Royal Enfield, all these great names that used to be part of the sort of DNA of the Midlands. I mean, they just disappeared so quickly. But the Austin Rover one was a disaster because there are great hopes for it, weren't there? And when that went, there really was a great shock around that area because so many people depended on that. So many car workers and their families really dependent on that huge site. I forget how many people it used to employ now, years and years ago, but I don't know, 40,000-50,000 people, something like that. Plus all the families who depend on the wages coming out of that. When I first started at ATV, it was an area where there was a huge amount of money generated in that part of the world. I mean, you'd go to, say, the Longbridge Social Club. These had these great social evenings and so on. And the amount of money being spent over the bar was phenomenal because there was big money being earned on those car tracks. You know, you might get a household where there's mom might be out working, something to do with the Austin Rover, dad would be working at the Rover, and then a couple of sons would be working. Well, you imagine all those wages going into one household and their spending capacity was phenomenal. And suddenly all that went very, very quickly. And now, well, what have we got now? Got a shopping centre now. Seems to be thriving, actually, by the way, Longbridge Shopping Centre. But it is strange. You sort of think, well, hold on. There was a massive industry here. Can you make it out of just selling stuff to each other? I don't know. You know, it's where's the manufacturing base? When I was a kid, you know, in Walsall, I remember there was full employment. I nearly said unemployment. There was full employment in those days, and every street used to have a bit of manufacturing going on. There was a curious smell about Walsall. You'd wake up in the morning and you'd smell this. There were leather tanneries which kick out a particular pong, and then there was the Highgate Brewery which was mashing up. And then the brass founders sort of kicking out different smells. I mean, you could cut it with a knife. You really could. There was a sort of smell of industry around the Walsall area. And all these little workshops working away. Everybody, there's bits of anodizing going on, brass founding, leather tanneries. It was humming with activity. And suddenly all that's well, I won't say it's all gone, but it's pretty well gone.
Yeah.
It all went almost overnight. And I'm not sure what's replaced it is quite as good, frankly. In fact, my own opinion is that it's not. I mean, the town now is, one hates to be critical of your sort of your hometown, but it's kind of died a lot. It's a bit like, you know, Kidderminster is another one. You know, it used to be a town which was bubbling with manufacture, carpet manufacturers. And so on. I mean, you go down the high street now in Kidderminster, it's just full of charity shops and so on. There's still plenty of people around. There's still, you know, there are successful shops and all this, but a lot of the life has left these wonderful Midland towns, smaller towns and so on. The industry's gone and it seems to me the lifeblood has been sucked out of these towns.
Yeah, it feels like that in Ulster sometimes. I remember my family moved to Ulster, Bob, in 1993. I was only 3 years old at the time, but I remember it was just charity shops, and then we went through a phase of having lots of banks, and there was a phase of estate agents all over the place. But sometimes you walk down some of these local high streets in these towns, and there's no life anymore, and it's really quite sad, actually.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the only light, they all seem to turn into coffee shops.
Yes, that's true. Everyone's, I think all this working from home, people go and put their laptop in a coffee shop and sit there all day, don't they?
Yes.
Well, Bob, as we said, there's been good and bad, and it's nice to have had all those light-hearted moments over the years. But let's go back now to, I'm not going to say the highlight, because it was very much a low light of your ATV Today days, and that was November 1974. And the pub bombings in Birmingham. Two bombs exploded, didn't there? There was one in the mulberry bush at the base of the rotunda. And then just 10 minutes later, Tavern in the Town, which was a basement pub on New Street, a third bomb was stopped, was prevented, luckily, on the Hagley Road. But even so, 21 people lost their lives. There was a further 182 injured. And you were one of the first reporters, weren't you, on the scene and actually broadcast live into the national news at 10. So a terrible time. But what do you remember of the day?
Well, it's scorched into my memory. Of course it is. What I remember particularly of the day, obviously there was the panic, the feeling that there could be many more bombs around at the time. But as a reporter, I remember my job. I mean, people say to me, well, don't, you know, weren't you upset about it? Didn't it upset you? And I said, well, not at the time. You know, any upset came later. In fact, to be honest, when I think back on it now, I get more upset now thinking about it than I did actually at the time. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, I realized that very quickly that I was right on top of a story that was going to break around the world. And my task was to get as much accurate information as possible. See, when bombs go off and create so much destruction, you've got no idea at the time how many people are killed or injured. And there's a bit of guesswork that goes on there, and you want to try and get as much accurate information within a very short period of time. It's a really difficult task. And I forget now what I actually said on News at 10 that night, because I went back into the studio and did a hurried injection into News at 10, the national news, and where I was interviewed by, I think I've got a feeling it might have been Rachel Bosenkett, I forget now who it was, or Ivor Mills, one of the presenters there. I just remember thinking, gosh, I hope I'm right in this, because I was giving facts as I'd got them and figures, which, as it turned out, weren't too wide of the mark. But I realized it was a huge responsibility to try and get the right information out. And that's all you're thinking about, really. Plus, of course, trying to get film together and trying to film in very, very difficult circumstances. And all the while, it's all going on around you that you don't know if there are going to be any more bombs. I remember running through Birmingham New Street Station with a can of film, because of course we're on film in those days, running back to what I thought would be a shortcut to the studio. And I literally tripped over one of these remote controlled machines going into search for another suspected bomb.
Wow.
And I thought, whoa, you know, because there was so much panic going on that night that really nobody knew the extent of the attack. As it turned out, of course, it was two bombs, but for all anybody knew at that time, it could have been 20 bombs. So I look back on it as a night of feverish activity. But the memories, as I say, they're seared into my soul, because even today, of course, the Birmingham bombings has never got closure.
No,
you know,
no.
It's the and the poor people who really want to know who really was responsible have never got their answer, and I feel very sorry for them. I really do.
And of course, another huge story was the Birmingham Six being freed, wasn't it? And although the bombings happened in November 74, the Birmingham Six weren't freed until 91. And like you say, It seems unbelievable, doesn't it, that all these years later, we still don't have any full closure on the whole thing?
It's 50 years, and there are still many questions which are unanswered.
Mm.
And people seem to be very reluctant to set up an inquiry into it, and you have to ask why. But there we are. I think, sadly, so many people now, because we're all getting older, we'll go to our graves with those great questions unanswered. But there we are. Yes, that's, I won't say one of the highlights, but certainly one of the more dramatic moments in my career.
Indeed. Well, that was November 1974, as we say. And then, of course, things really changed, didn't they? New Year's Day 1982 is when ATV became Central. ATV Today became Central News. And you were there, Bob, presenting that very first episode alongside Wendy Nelson.
Is Central News.
Well, that was the start of it, and of course it would go on until 2022 for you, Bob, but you must have met so many interesting people over the years, not just the people you've worked with, Nick Owen, Ann Diamond, John Swaddow, Chris Tarrant, but also all the people you've met as interviewees as well. Who are some of the standouts for you?
Yeah, I can't remember half of them really, Greg. That's, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but somehow you're always working towards the next interview. And there, and it's very often, it's not famous people who give you the best interviews.
Yeah.
It's very often, you know, ordinary people who do extraordinary things. And, you know, I mean, we've got to, I always cite this man as being just one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. And he's a man called Blind Dave Healy. Dave Healy, who's blind. Okay. And Blind Dave, I forget how he came across his blindness. It was something genetic. I mean, he lost his sight many years ago. But he took up things like running for charity, you know, running across deserts. And he did, five marathons. I think it was five marathons on five different continents in 5 days. I mean, remarkable man, you know, extraordinary man. And then he's done, you know, various, he's run across the Sahara. He's always raising money. And I see Blind Dave occasionally. I saw him just the other night, actually, at some do. And he's one of these chaps who's so effusive, and he just makes you feel good, because he's got this terrible blindness. He's completely blind, can't see a thing. But it never stops him going out and setting challenges for himself and overcoming these challenges and raising huge amounts of money in the meantime. I mean, what wonderful people. What an extraordinary character. And it's people like him who give great joy to life, and I enjoy meeting.
It definitely it puts things in perspective, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It does indeed. But, going back all those characters, all those people over the years, you know, I was just thinking, one of the extraordinary things about going from ATV to Central is that it's all done in a way by smoke and mirrors, because the same people who were there the day before were there in the new company. So in many things, nothing had changed. But what did happen, and it was so clever, is that we went home on a Friday night working for ATV. And on the Monday morning, we arrived working for Central TV. What was the difference? It was all done with paint and stripes. They completely went through and rebranded all the studios completely over the weekend. Anything to do with ATV was literally binned. I've got a bit of it myself, actually, because I scooped up bits and pieces myself, because it was part of the history of television, really. But the following morning, all you could smell was paint, and they painted it out in the new Central colors with the sort of rainbow stripes everywhere and so on. And you really felt as though you were working for a new company. And we were working for a new company. It was a new company, but with the same people. It was an extraordinary feeling. It was very cleverly done.
And it's amazing, isn't it? Because we mentioned it was 1956 when it all started in black and white on ATV. And that was, if I'm not mistaken, a derelict West End cinema, I think. And Patricia Cox started it there. Then Reg Harcourt came in around 1962. Went to Broad Street. That was a new site for colour transmission. But then it moved, didn't it? So Central Television was taken over by Carlton. That was 94. And then it moved to Central Court, just around the corner from Broad Street, in 1997. So you've seen all these changes, but it's funny how a lot of the same people were involved all the way through, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I've seen, have I seen some changes? I mean, I tell people, I'm getting so old, honestly, Greg. I've seen so many changes in Birmingham itself. I mean, I have seen three bull rings. I remember the very first bull ring because I remember I used to go there with my mother, really, when it was a sort of open-air market because it had been bombed out. Then I remember the next bull ring, which was built in the late 50s, early 60s. And then, of course, this third bull ring. And I've seen three libraries. I remember the very old library, which was in Victoria Square, and then that came down. Then the Ziggurat library went up, you know, the one that was it Prince Charles, now King Charles, of course, who looked at it and said, good Lord, it looks like an incinerator for burning books rather than reading books. I remember that.
That's classic. That's classic Charles, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And now that's gone. And, of course, we've got a new library. So these things, they change dramatically. I mean, Birmingham, gosh, doesn't it keep, it keeps renewing itself. It has the capacity. It's what makes it an amazing city, really. It has the capacity to keep renewing and renewing and renewing. And it is a remarkable city. Anyway, as I say, I keep going through all these rebirths of institutions in Birmingham, and I'm still here. I feel endangered.
It's amazing. My grandmother, Joyce, she was born in 1932 in Irving Street, in the back street houses of Irving Street in Birmingham. And obviously that's all long gone now, isn't it? And my dad worked on Smallbrook Queensway, just down the road from the Bullring. I don't know if you remember Apricot Computers, Bob, but it was Apricot Computer World, which then became Computer World. And when you walk down there now, it just feels like they need to rip the whole lot down and start again. It's very 60s, 70s.
Yeah, I remember Apricot Computers, because was that not set up by a chap called Foster?
Yes, Roger Foster, yes.
See, my memory's not that bad, is it? he lived Wolverhampton way. He lived in, I forget where it was now, but he lived over in Wolverhampton. Apricot Computers, golly, yes, I remember that.
Well, that was Central. And obviously, you also had a stint, Bob, before Central, actually. You went to Yorkshire Television, didn't you, for a while, and hosted Calendar, which seems hard to believe now is the UK's first ever breakfast TV show.
Well, what it was, I got an opportunity to go and work on some documentaries, actually, to work at Yorkshire Television. And when I arrived there, because people say, oh, God, Yorkshire Television. Poor, I don't know how you're going to get on with people in Yorkshire. You know, they're a different... Well, I've got to tell you, I had three wonderful years up there in Yorkshire. I absolutely loved it. And older people remember the name Austin Mitchell. he was the main presenter of Calendar. I wasn't working on Calendar at first. And Austin Mitchell went off to be MP for Grimsby. And his number two was Richard Whiteley of Countdown fame. Richard Whiteley popped up into the number one position, and they're looking around for somebody who'd done a bit of presenting, and they said, oh, Bob Warman, yeah, hey, how do you fancy it? I said, oh, okay, you know, so I went from working on documentaries into presenting Calendar. And I had three wonderful years there, and I really enjoyed it. I loved Yorkshire, and I've still got good friends up in Yorkshire, friends that I made there during that time. And Richard Whiteley became one of my closest ever friends. We funny enough, we didn't hit it off straight away because I think he thought I was, you know, I was competition. But I didn't want to take his job because he was Mr. Yorkshire after all. You know, that was ridiculous. And but in the latter year that I was at Yorkshire Television, we became very close friends. The moment I moved back to Central Television, back to the Midlands, we became the closest of friends. And I miss him enormously because we used to travel the world together. We always went on holiday together, and we traveled many parts of the world together. And he was a fabulous chap. He was a terrific travel companion. He was a great raconteur, wonderful sense of humor. And I miss him. I miss him enormously. He was godfather to my son, and we do miss Uncle Richard. There we are. He's been long gone now.
Yeah, well, we lost him in 2005, didn't we? Shocking, way too young. I'm glad you've mentioned Richard, though, Bob. Let's have a listen to this. This is when you were celebrating your 30th anniversary in 2003, and this was a bit of a surprise by the Central team for you.
30 years.
Oh, my old mate.
30 years, and he can still pronounce Royal Horse Artillery. Well done. The man's still got, he's still working.
Yeah, what a great surprise. What a lovely surprise.
How did you two meet? How did you get to know each other?
Well, shall I tell the story? Oh, it was way back in 1975 when ATV was, you know, there, and he was poached by the producer of Yorkshire TV Calendar, which I was the anchorman of, to come to Yorkshire to kick me out.
To lick your job?
Yep, to lick my job. Yes, my dear. Saw him off. Yeah, I saw him off.
You're still good.
How long did you try for 2 years?
Then I tried 2 or 3 years.
And then you gave up. Had to come back.
Yeah. But you're also very good chums, aren't you? That's
We're good great friends, partners. Actually. He's my oldest friend in the business, actually. And
We're not talking about age, are we?
No, I mean, unfortunately, it's hard to believe. I'm actually older, slightly older than him. And it's a constant source of annoyance to me that he's never going to be as old as me.
Still got his own teeth, though, haven't
you? Well, I have, actually.
Well, at least he's got his own hair.
Let's see yours. Take yours out. Let's see yours. But actually, funnily enough, Bob, it's 35 years to this very day that I started at Yorkshire Television, funny enough. So,
more congratulations.
Absolutely. What an emotional day. I'm filling
you
up.
Help us eat the cake.
I think it's fair to point out that Bob has been a little nervous for a while. He's seen these people moving around.
You know what it's like.
He thought something was going on.
The newsroom have been in strange silence today, and I knew that something was... It's a great surprise.
Well, they promised you a big star, Bob, and I'm sorry they could only do a bit. You're a great chap, and from my eerie in Yorkshire, I know you are Mr. Midlands, and very much highly respected here. You've done a marvellous job, and he's fantastic.
And we all love him.
And regional stations need long-serving, mature... authoritative guys like this.
Careful. Where is he?
Where is he? Yes, we can find him.
They have a big red book soon.
This is your life, isn't it?
Funny listening to that, Bob, thinking even that's 20 years ago. But I feel like I knew Richard Whiteley and I never met the man, but I feel like I know him really well.
Oh, he was that sort of character. that was lovely hearing all that again. Gosh, that brings back some great memories.
It's funny, isn't it, hearing him say, "But Bob came to try and nick my job," and he means it. But it's lovely, isn't it?
Yes, he did feel that. I'm sure he did. Yeah, but it also back in those days, we did the first breakfast television experiment, and that was back in 1977. And it was an experiment, a 3-month experiment to see whether it would, you know, whether it would get some sort of audience, and it was the precursor, really, to TVAM starting up. I did it for 3 months, and at the end of that 3 months, I swore that I never, ever wanted to do breakfast television as long. I didn't care how much money they'd chuck at me.
Wow.
I didn't care how much money they'd chuck at me. I just did not want to do breakfast television.
Why? Because it was too early to get up, or?
Oh, it was ridiculous. You know? I mean, more than taking over your life, you know, it ruined your life, really. I've always enjoyed a very good social life, Greg, I've got to be honest. And I've always enjoyed a life outside television. It's been important to me. And there was no life working on breakfast television. I mean, when you're having to go to bed at sort of, you know, 8 o'clock in the evening to get up at three o'clock in the morning and all this sort of thing, it was really throwing me around. But it was an interesting experiment for me because at the end of it, I knew I didn't. That was one of the things I knew I didn't want to do. And one of the things that I've learned in life is to actually try and swerve the things you don't want to do. And I never wanted to do breakfast telly. And by the way, I never watch it either. I don't watch it. It's the wrong time of the day for me completely.
Yeah, well, the only bits I watch are later when they're on YouTube, when you can watch them in the afternoon or in the evening, actually. I watch more breakfast TV in the evening than at breakfast time.
That's right.
Another voice we heard there, who also sadly isn't with us anymore, was Bob Hall. And here you are chatting with Bob a few years ago.
You know how you bump into people in the street and they say, do you know, I've been watching you for years and you don't change. What a load of rubbish.
Are you suggesting we look ever so slightly different? You have more than once used me as a good link out of something, and not least the changing colour of my hair. I mean, I've never mentioned the fact that if the lights were on the back end, we'd get a bit of a flash, but there we are.
Seems like another really nice guy, Bob, and the changing colour of his hair. Oh, yeah. So you used to like that as a bit of a link in and out of items.
Yeah, we used to take the mickey out of each other. But he was a great professional, you know. He was somebody who, in a live situation, could get you out of a mess. He was terrific at picking up. And he could ad-lib for 2 or 3 minutes, no trouble at all. He was a great professional in live television. Superb. One of the best. Really, I mean that. One of the best. And sadly missed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Bob Warman.
Yeah.
He's still going.
No.
Yeah?
What's his trick? It's Birmingham. He's like, I'm 61, I'm still going.
Well, he sent you a picture there.
All right. I'll pin that on my dressing room table.
That was Ozzy Osbourne himself, of course, the lead man of Sabbath. That was back in 2010. It must be nice, though, when you hear these people. Is it nice to hear Black, you know, Ozzy Osbourne recognising you and seeing you in a picture?
Yeah. I feel very humbled. Yeah. Oh, these fantastic people. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's been some terrific people who have come out of the Midlands, haven't they? In the music world and so on. I mean, Black Sabbath, Led Zepp, and so on and so on. Yeah. The Moody's. Yellow, particularly. Yeah. It just goes on and on and on. What a terrific. Terrific part of the world for music. Fantastic.
It was Slade. Have you met, you must have met Noddy Holger, I guess.
Oh, of course I've met Noddy, yes. Oh, God, he's royalty, isn't he? Noddy,
incredible. Yeah. Yeah. Now, moving away, Bob, from the news, let's have a listen to The Price is Right, because this was a different venture for you altogether.
You're the first four contestants on The Price is Right. Welcome to The Price is Right. Hello to our first four contestants, Kerry, Sandra, Richard and Eileen. Let's kick off and find out what's first up for bids.
A sherry decanter and glasses. Drinks before dinner are always a pleasure, but take your sherry with added style from this crystal decanter, complemented perfectly by this matching set of glasses. It's a definite must for all your special occasions.
And I'd like one bid from each of you, please, and the one who bids closest to the actual price without going over wins the prize, joins me for a pricing game. Kerry?
I've got to say, Bob, it always makes me laugh hearing the prizes that were on offer and the descriptions of them. But what was it like doing, you've done the telethons, there was Miss ATV, Price is Right. How did a quiz show like that compare to the news?
Well, I could tell you so much about my short experience with a game show like The Price is Right. I mean, funny enough, hearing that voice of the introductory voice was a wonderful man called Bobby Bragg, who was the warm-up man for people like, trying to think now, he was Wogan's warm-up man. I'm trying to think one or two others now. He was a terrific chap, and he used to warm the audience up. So they're absolutely ready for it, you know, absolutely raring to go once the show was being recorded. It was a very interesting experience for me because I learned a lot. We did, I think, about 65 shows in Muir in a couple of months, something like that. So it was recording almost back to back, two or three shows a day. And I learned an awful lot. I learned, for one thing, how much more challenging it is than you imagine being a game show host. There are so many things you have to think about. And particularly with The Price is Right, there are well over 100 different games in The Price is Right. And your exposition, your explanation of each game has to be absolutely word perfect. And it has to be explained in a way that the contestant understands it straight away. There's no umming and ahhing about it. But I learned a very interesting thing about human nature as well, because the prizes, I know that it was a set of decanters or something like that, sherry glass and decanter, yeah. but this was for Sky Television, and there were no restrictions on the prizes as there had been with commercial television, with ITV, when Leslie Crowther used to present it. Now, why wasn't Leslie Crowther doing it for Sky? Because he was too expensive and I was cheap. And that's how I got rode into doing it, because there wasn't much of a budget. But some of the prizes were fantastic. And I learned this, that if you said to a contestant, and our big prize tonight is you're going to be picked up, taken by limousine to an airport where you're going to be flown to the south of France, where you're going to join a cruise ship which will go all around the Mediterranean and all that sort of thing. People would look slightly shocked by it at first. But if you said, and tonight's star prize, it's a microwave oven, they'd go mad. And I said to the producer, I don't understand this. I said, they go mad for a microwave oven, but they don't seem to go quite so mad for the trip of a lifetime. He said, well, the trouble is, when you give them the trip of a lifetime, suddenly you're presenting a whole load of problems, which they never had 30 seconds ago. Problems like, can I get the time off work? What shall I wear?
Right,
have I got enough money? All these problems suddenly go through their minds, and they're stunned by it. They're immediately stunned by it, by the immediate problem. Whereas if you say microwave oven, well, they can see that straight in the kitchen straight away. I'll have that, thank you very much. So there's a lot of psychology goes on with these things. So you learn a lot, and I learned. I enjoyed doing The Price is Right. I enjoyed it very much, but it was very, very hard work. Because we're turning these shows around so quickly, as I say, doing two or three a day, with different audiences being busted and so on, and I was having to quickly. I had a sort of Price is Right Bible where I had to quickly learn up the games very, very quickly, and make sure I could explain them. Some of them were rather more complicated than others, but so it was a big challenge. But I really enjoyed it. It was something else to tick the box. I wasn't that good. I know that, and I bow to those who really know how to run a good game show.
Here's one man who certainly does.
Of course, the old boy's clonking on a bit. God knows he's nearly as old as me. But to achieve that longevity and that much respect and that much love and warmth for this figure in the corner of your room every night takes a lot of years of hard craft, you know. So he's put the hard hours in, and just because he's not on the telly anymore locally, people won't forget him. And I think pretty much, particularly through the years of all his news reporting, whatever, people got to know that Bob Warman is a straight-talking guy, and I think they trust him.
Chris Tarrant there, of course. It's amazing. As I said before, Bob, you were born on the 11th of October, 1946. Chris was born on the 10th of October, 1946.
Yes, I know. The unmistakable, amazing Chris Tarrant. Oh, what an extraordinary chap. You know, one of my very early memories, I've got to tell you this. One of my very early memories of Chris is we did an item on the programme about fireworks. It was firework night coming up, and it was about dangerous fireworks. And we had all these display of all these dangerous fireworks. And there were dozens and dozens of them. I don't know, they were cheap imports from China or something like that. They were dangerous, and we were warning our viewers not to buy these fireworks, or if they had them, not to use them, all that sort of. So, of course, what happens after the program? Chris comes around to my house bearing all these fireworks.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And we had the most amazing firework party. Most of the fireworks, I've got to tell you, let off inside the house. I mean, he was crazy, was Chris. He really was. He was wicked. But, you know, there you are, you see. I mean, what a talent. What a talent Chris Tarrant is. Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like John Swallow, Chris in the ATV days, ATV Today, decided very early that he'd rather do the lighthearted stuff, didn't he? Which, of course, led on to Tiz Was. And it's quite, I suppose, a millionaire in the hot seat with the suit and the tie was the most serious we probably ever saw him. But he clearly decided he wanted to go down the lighthearted route more than the serious journalism, didn't he?
Yeah, and not forget, of course, his many, many years on radio.
Yes.
Where he's, you know, tremendously successful on radio coming out of London. But that was Chris, yes. He broke a few molds, did Chris, in television. So on. It wasn't just Tiz Was, but there are other programs where he really broke the mold. Probably some programs which wouldn't be allowed to go out today, I don't think. They probably wouldn't be politically correct and so on. But they were damn funny programs and quite risque, some of them, certainly by today's standards. But he wasn't afraid to break the mold and go for different types of entertainment. Yeah, you know, busting out of the envelope. He's a great broadcaster, and of course, you know, we see touches of it with his great railway journeys and all that sort of thing. Now, as you say, Millionaire was a real turning point for Chris. And I mean, he got the authority in the studio with Millionaire, very much so. And he handled it, and he handled the disappointments of many in Millionaire. And
it was an incredible program, wasn't it? I remember it starting, and you know, with the music and the drama and the tension, it was unlike anything we'd ever really seen before. It's also funny. My dad's told me of a story. His mum and dad, Joyce and John, lived in Hockley Heath, and my dad went to Henley and Arden School, high school. And Chris, I believe, Bob, you'd know better than me, was living in Henley for a while. And apparently a lot of the kids used to come out of school, and there was a running joke to put, I think it was a lettuce, through Chris's letterbox in Henley.
Probably.
It's the sort of thing he would probably do. So I guess he got a bit of his own back.
He was the perfect, you know, looking back, he was the perfect choice, really, for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Because when you're dealing with quiz shows like that, where, you know, and there's big, big money involved, and the possibility of really winning big money, it's how you handle people when they dip out early, you know, to handle the disappointment. Chris was very, very good at that. He was a sort of arm around the shoulder man. He was very good at it. He really was.
Now, another man who was a legend for completely different reasons was Percy Tate. And we were talking about him before we started recording, weren't we? And I know the name as an ex-motorcycle racer, obviously. Even as when I was a kid, I remember the name. But I remember it most of all because of the Suzuki garage, the petrol station, and the garage they had in Ulster, Percy Tate Motors. But as I've now found out, Bob, he was a good friend of yours. Small world.
He was, and we go back again a very long way. I first met Percy Tate in the Gambia. I was on a cheapo holiday in the Gambia, and across the swimming pool was this face that I recognized. He didn't know me in those days, but I knew him through motorcycle, you know, because I got an interest in motorcycling and so on. And I remember saying to my wife at the time, I said, God, that's Percy Tate across the way there. And the Gambia was one of these places where you'd be sitting by the swimming pool and suddenly people would bolt upright and make a run for going inside the hotel, and you knew what it was. They got Montezuma's revenge. And and at one stage, I was sitting up bolt upright because I picked up some horrible tummy bug there, and I'd be sort of shooting inside. Then Percy Tate would be inside, and we met as we sort of crossed each other going to the loo, and we laughed about it inside. But what was very funny about Percy was when we're leaving the Gambia, we went through this rather basic security system, which they had in those days, and it kept going off because they were stripping Percy down and trying to find out why the bells were going off all the time, why the alarms were going off, and they got him down to his swimming trunks at the end of the day, or his pants, and they still couldn't find anything on him. Well, of course, he was full of bits of metal rod and titanium and God knows what, through all his injuries. I mean, because he'd come off his bike a few times, he'd got a lot of injuries at Percy. And we laughed about that. Anyway, when we got there, we became very close friends, And this was towards the, well, it was at the end of his motorcycle racing days, because he had a fantastic record as his works rider for Triumph motorcycles, and then he rode for Suzuki and so on. But he gave up the motorcycling and opened up various a number of garages. I think he had about four or five garages called Percy Tate Suzuki Motors, and with his wife Di, and they did very well. But then Percy, he came originally, I think, from farming stock up north, and he had a great love of livestock and sheep in particular. And he became a breeder of rare sheep, rare breeds. And he won. I mean, he got a cabinet full of cups for his motorcycle racing, but he got about three times more cabinets for his for cups that he won on rare breeds. And it's one of my greatest regrets that I never did a program about Percy Tate, because what a remarkable contrast from going from death-defying TT racing into the slow world of sheep in pastures. I mean, you can't imagine it. What a contrast. Yeah. But he was very, very one of the most successful breeders of rare breeds in the country. And he had a great love of sheep, and that was my abiding memory of Percy. He was a fabulous character, you know. He was terrific, and I actually gave the eulogy at his funeral back in 2019. So much missed. He was a lovely, lovely character, and it was interesting who turned up at his funeral. I mean, a lot of the old bikers, they were at the crematorium where it was held. There were one or two very, very old, magnificent racing bikes, you know, from the days of yore. Great character, loved him.
And Bob, how did you get involved in bikes? And I guess you've watched a lot of races and probably attended a few over the years, because you did ride a Norton, actually, didn't you, at Donington Park on Central News a few years ago, and you've flown in a Spitfire, and you've, well, or did you ride the Norton at Donington? There were some impressive wheelies, but I'm pretty sure it was you.
I did ride a Norton out of when they set up again at Castle Donington.
Yeah.
I took one around the circuit, as it were, but it was a stunt. I forget the name of the rider now who did a few wheelies, and we played it for a joke on the program as if it was me. The number of people who were taken in by it.
Really? So did a lot of people actually thought it was you doing the wheelies, did they?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, very funny. Because I've been a rider for several years, actually. I got my first bike, my first proper bike, big bike, was a Kawasaki Z1A 900. And that was one of the very first of the big super bikes. Fantastic thing. And I got hold of one of those in 1976. I remember it was the great summer, the great heat wave of 76. And I used to ride up and down from Yorkshire, because I just started at Yorkshire Television in those days. And I used to ride up and down to Leeds. I used to go over through the Derbyshire Dales and so on, and rather than go over the motorways. And I used to go, I mean, it's ridiculous when I think about it now, but I was in a crash helmet and a pair of shorts. And I used to arrive talk about sunburnt, you know, I was I loved that bike. I went from passing my test on something like a little Honda into this great super bike, which was ridiculous when you think about it. But what a lovely bike it was. And, you know, gosh, I wish I still had it today, because the Z1A, the Kawasaki Z1A, is a classic motorcycle nowadays. You know, people pay a lot of money for a good example of one of those. It's like a lot of these things. Gosh, I wish I'd hung on to it. Gosh, I wish I'd hung on to all the cars I've had in my life and so on. But there we are. You don't, do you? You just move on to the next thing and you... And then I had a Moto Guzzi California, which was another lovely touring bike. And I love these big bikes. Sadly, I don't have a bike now. I got rid of my last bike fairly recently, and which was a Honda, which I sold it to some chap in Leicestershire, and he turned it into a bobber, and it's now somewhere up in Scotland. And I can't believe how this beautiful bike of mine, which was a lovely sort of custom-built bike, has now been turned into a bobber, and some bikes tearing around it up in Scotland. But there we go. that's the biking world. Yeah.
And you're still watching much of it, Bob? You'll have to come along if you ever fancy coming to the Superbikes. Let me know. It'll be great to have you there. But do you still watch much of the racing, the Formula One or Superbikes, MotoGP?
I watch it on television. There's nothing more exciting, is there? I mean, no. I just think motorcycle racing is just the most exciting sport. Terrific. Love it. I mean, these guys, you know, I kind of hero worship them, because I know the speeds they get up to. I know the risks that they take.
Yeah.
They don't see it as risks. They say everything's calculated and all this, but particularly the TT. I mean, he's just extraordinary. You know, it's got to be them. Well, it's, I don't know. I'm surprised it's still going, actually, in some ways, the TT. It's never without its fatalities. I forget how many people have been killed at the TT over the years, but it's pretty frightening. But when you see the speeds these guys get up to, it's fantastic, fantastic. And the skill of these riders is unbelievable.
Have you ever been? I've never actually been to the Isle of Man, believe it or not. Have you been and seen the event?
No, and I'd love to go, actually. I really would love to.
Yeah, me too.
You've got
the time now, Bob. You can go and do it probably in the next few years.
Well, perhaps I ought to. Yes. I mean, there's so many things I want to go and do. In fact, I'm going to do them. There are various things I'm going to do. I mean, one of the things I'm going to do this summer, and I've been promising myself to do it, but never had the time. My grandfather, a Walsall man, he was killed at Gallipoli in 1915, and he is buried somewhere in Gallipoli or near Gallipoli. And there is a memorial along with all those that fell at Gallipoli, a place called Helles, the Helles Memorial. And it's a bit of a remote place to get to. I mean, you've got to fly to Istanbul and probably take a car, and sort of, it's probably a 3 or 4 hour journey out of Istanbul. But I'd love to go and see it. My father never did, never even thought about it, I don't think. But I have the will and the interest to go and do it. I'm just interested to go there. I mean, it's ridiculous, really, because when I arrived there, having gone through quite a difficult journey to actually get there, all I'll do is stare at a plaque. But it'll mean something to me, and I want to go and do it. It's like these small things, you know. It's always been in my mind, because I just want to go and see the environment in which my grandfather lost his life. So there you are. So that's one thing, and various other things, because I've got the time.
Before we go, Bob, and finally, to use a newsy phrase, what next? Because just reeling off a few achievements, there's the Baird Medal you've won, the highest honour from the Royal Television Society for an outstanding contribution to the Midlands television community, an honorary doctorate from Birmingham City University, an MBE for services to broadcasting and journalism, which sadly turned out to be Her Majesty the Queen's last ever birthday honours list last year. And now Knight of the Stars, of course, Birmingham Rep, Tuesday the 9th of May with this man.
He certainly helped me out a lot. No, he's never helped me out. I've helped him more than he's helped me, and I've never helped him. So it's been a wonderful relationship between the both of us. They'll have to kill Bob with a stick. I mean, he'll be round when he's 250.
There's a while to go then, Bob, judging by Jasper Carrot's words. But tell us about the Night of the Stars then. I know it's sold out. I know you're quite embarrassed about that because it took about 5 minutes to sell out. Do you know who these special guests are that Jasper's got involved?
I don't. They're some of his old mates. I don't. That's part of the appeal of the evening, I think.
Yeah.
But once, because you know, we went on television to talk about it, and the moment we came off air, suddenly all the seats had gone. You know, it was
incredible.
The power of telly.
Yeah,
the power of telly. So, but it'll be an evening to look forward to, and well, what follows that, I'm not sure.
Well, Bob, thank you very much. No doubt, chat again at some point. Good luck with the Night of the Stars. I'm going to be interested to see who Carrot gets involved on that one. I think I can guess a few, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few unsuspected guests there. It's going to be interesting.
It will be. Yeah, well said. Interesting's the word, yeah. Good to talk to you, Greg. Good to talk to you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, there we are. It just goes to show how fast time flies, doesn't it? But we've been talking away with Mr. Midlands himself. Good luck for your retirement, Bob Warman. And the Talking Away podcast is now also available on social media, Twitter, Talking Away Pod, and Instagram, Talking Away Podcast. If you have any thoughts or ideas, perhaps even criticisms of the show, feel free to get in touch as well by email, talkingawaypodcast@gmail.com.